From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. We'll be looking at the coronavirus, which landed in Latin America on February 26th with Brazil's confirmation of a case in Sao Paulo. Since then, governments across the region have taken an array of actions to protect citizens and to contain the COVID-19 spread. And we're going to take a look at some of those to see what's worked where and why and how. Welcome, Tony, and I'm glad to be able to have a conversation with you about the many things that are going on in the region there, because it's been one hell of a week.
No, obviously, the main thing that's going on is the very varied response to the COVID-19 public health crisis across the region.
Yeah.
And Among the countries that have been extremely successful both in addressing the public health crisis in their own country and in assisting other countries, not just in Latin America, but around the world,
right,
has been Cuba.
That's right.
You know, I'm this tiny island just off the southeast coast of the United States that has been the subject of extreme economic boycott and blockade and military threats as well. They recently celebrated the anniversary of the abortive invasion of the Playa Girón,
yeah,
back in whenever it was, 1962 or whenever it was.
Yep, 1961.
And the United States suffered what was, in regional terms, a very humiliating military defeat.
A butt whooping. That's right. It was John F. Kennedy's first introduction to international relations, power politics, and finding out where he stood with his own elite, as a matter of fact. 2 months into his administration, he took office January 20th, 1961, with the, you know, out there in the freezing cold, with the ask not what your country can do for you and all that. Right away, he's saying, okay, go ahead and invade, because that's what the Dulles brothers told him he could do. And they landed down there and they got their behinds whooped.
Yeah. And that was an astonishing achievement by the Cuban people, led by Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and their comrades.
That's right.
And the U.S. has never forgiven them. And that's basically what you're talking about. You're talking about the United States maintaining extremely vindictive, sadistic, cynical sanctions against Cuba for, 60 years?
Yep.
Almost 60 years.
Yep.
Just because they were too incompetent to be able to crush a country, at that time with a population about the 20th or at that time, the size of the United States. Anyway, yeah. And that's worth remembering.
Yep.
And so currently that, and that's still reflected right now, even in the middle of this global public health crisis caused by this COVID-19 virus. And what you're finding is that the United States is actually far from relaxing sanctions. It's actually intensified the sanctions over the last couple of months.
That's right.
And as they have also done against Venezuela. And they're doing, why are they doing that? They're doing that because they think, well, if we squeeze just a little bit more right now when they're really hurting, maybe that we'll be able to finally achieve our objective.
That's right.
That we haven't been able to achieve in 60 years. That's the object of the exercise.
Yep.
And the latest outrage that they've engaged in their efforts to their genocidal attack on the Cuban people, because that's what it comes down to. They've now targeted shipping lines that are sending medicines to Cuba from the United States, and ingredients for Cuba's pharmaceutical industry, one of the most successful and creative and inventive pharmaceutical industries in the world, so that Cuba's pharmaceutical industry can't produce the medicines that it has been producing to serve not just its own population, but populations all around the world.
Right.
For example, it's very well-known interferon medicine that's been so successful in treating a wide range of very serious condition.
That's right.
Because it builds up the body's immunity against conditions like HIV, and also it's been proven to be relatively successful against this COVID-19 virus.
That's right.
So the United States, instead of relaxing sanctions and trying to enable Cuba in the region to do a better job of taking care of its people, and of course people in the region, because that's what Cuba does,
right,
as the Jamaican government recently recognized very publicly, praising Cuba for its medical assistance. Instead of relaxing the sanctions somewhat, as the United Nations has called for, right? In an extremely tepid way, that's true, but at least they did try and say, right, well, this is a time for global solidarity and a relaxation and aggression and so forth. And the United States have, of course, paid no attention to it because it's the exceptional nation that can do what it likes, however cynical and hypocritical and sadistic what it does turns out to be.
Right.
So they targeted shipping lines, and in fact, to the point where medicines that had actually been unloaded in Havana's port had to be reloaded on those shipping lines vessels to be taken back to the States.
Yeah.
And that's how petty and mean United States policy has become in terms of imposing this boycott. But that hasn't stopped Cuba continuing to send medical delegations to assist countries that require assistance to reinforce their public health response to the threat of the COVID-19 virus. And so the latest example of that is that a delegation has just arrived in South Africa. No, and so not only is Cuba assisting countries like Jamaica, like Nicaragua, it's been invited back to countries that, even to countries that expelled medical brigades from Cuba in previous months.
Right.
For example, Brazil and Honduras.
Right.
So even these right-wing regimes, because they are regimes,
right,
not governments.
Right.
Throughout the Cuban medical brigades that have been working in their countries for years and years and years, they threw them out, and then within a matter of months, as a result of this public health crisis caused by the COVID-19 virus, they've been forced to invite the Cuban brigades back again because their own health systems aren't up to taking care of their own populations.
Mm.
And so, you know, in the case of Jamaica and Nicaragua and other countries in the region that have received, and Venezuela also, of course, that are constantly, and they regard the Cuban input of medical expertise and personnel as an integral part of their health systems,
right,
and that's just, you know, they appreciate the reality of Cuban medical solidarity, and they respect the tremendous knowledge and experience the Cubans have accumulated over many decades working in countries around the world, literally around the world,
right,
from Pakistan to South Africa to you name a country.
They're in Indonesia. 22 countries right now. Right now, they have people operating in 22 countries around the world. You have Qatar, Italy, you know, Mexico, Nicaragua. They've got some people there. I guess they're advising on preventative. Honduras and Venezuela, all across the Caribbean, and in Asia and Africa. It's, you know, Angola, Togo, and South Africa, as you said, where 217 people just arrived in South Africa from Cuba.
Yeah, no, and it is true to say that And there are private sector initiatives from the United States that send medical brigades to different countries.
Right.
But what you're talking about here is a government policy deliberately aimed at promoting international solidarity.
That's right.
Whereas, and you have the United States government trying to crush it.
Now, that's what right. They're punishing people.
And so there's no clear example of the sheer evil of U.S. government foreign policy. How could you possibly want to repress the kind of international medical initiative based on solidarity that has made Cuba one of the most beloved countries in the world among all the world's peoples? And the other thing about Cuba is that not only does it send out these medical delegations, and it offers its medicines on a solidarity basis as much as anything. You know, they're not out for profit.
Right.
You know, they're not like Bill Gates, who's arguing to keep the United States and Europe under lockdown until he can get a virus to get a vaccine to get.
Right.
You know, and it's exactly the opposite of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So then, I just thought it's really important to look at that And what do you think? Do you think you could get a clearer example of the contrast between the sheer nobility of the Cuban ideal,
right,
and the utter depravity of United States corporate capitalism?
Right. Look, you have two things that go on here. First of all, the example of the United States being stopped from invading and conquering Cuba took place at a moment in history in April of 1961, where the colonies were rebelling against the colonial powers across the world. In Africa, you had things going on from Algeria to then Angola and Lumumba in Congo, Guinea, across the continent. In Asia, the Vietnam War was underway. There were people's movements across both Southeast Asia and South Asia generally. You had from Thailand to Indonesia to all over the place. The example of someone successfully fighting off a colonial power, the colonial power in front of the world, was more than they could bear. And so the punishment that has been imposed since then is geared to that. Meanwhile, the example Cuba is showing is, okay, fine, you're starving us, we're poor, we're having fun down here on our little island anyway. And by the way, we have just studied and learned and taught ourselves and learned from others around the world how to heal. And so we're going around the world and doing that. And we can. And the response from the United States, instead of saying, okay, gee, let's learn from them and maybe we can give everybody health care and cut the cost in half, is to try to suffocate it. But I don't know how else you could describe the difference between the two systems. If that were, I remember Mr. Clemente in creative writing class in high school, if I were sitting in his class and wrote that out, he would say that was too heavy-handed a metaphor. You know, that it's too obvious that you have to be, a little use symbolism a little more. Because there's such a direct contrast between one is a murdering, vengeful, hostile, angry thing, and the other are a bunch of people trying to help each other.
Right. Yeah, and you can see the way that's also playing out in the comparison between countries like Venezuela and their response and in Colombia and Brazil. And maybe we should look at what's happening in Central America in terms of the COVID-19 crisis.
Yeah, you can compare the models, right? How does this work as opposed to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, so in Nicaragua, you've got a socialist inspired preventive health system, community-based, family-focused health system, which has learned an enormous amount from Cuba during the 1980s and developed according to Nicaragua's own characteristics over the last 30 years or so. And whereas in countries like South Korea and Taiwan and Japan and China also, and they focused on high tech digital technology to in particular with regard to tracing people and helping to control movements and so forth. And they in Nicaragua they just did traditional house to house visiting, as they have done in Venezuela and also in Cuba. Mm. And now the current figure is that they've done just over 4 million house to house visits in a country with a population of about 6.5 million.
Wow.
And obviously a lot of those visits are repeat visits,
yeah,
because the focus is on mainly on the urban and semi-urban areas,
right.
of Nicaragua.
Yeah, so where an infection can take root. Yeah, right.
Yeah, so what do they do with those visits? On those visits, they do educational work, encouraging people to take very seriously the preventive measures like hand washing, keeping surfaces clean, maintaining a reasonable distance from people when you're talking to them,
right,
paying particular attention to any family members that are in vulnerable populations like the elderly or people that have chronic health conditions and so on. And at the same time as they're doing that, they're monitoring to see if people have symptoms and just explaining to people what to do if they're concerned about anybody in their family or, you know, or for example, something that somebody wrote about this week in the Alliance for Global Justice has a regular column called Nika Notes that usually comes out on Thursdays. And this week they've had a local community worker from the United States who works closely with Nicaragua's Ministry of Health explaining how things work. And in her piece this week, this woman talks about how even people who came back from Costa Rica who sneaked across the border without going through the formal frontier posts, because one of the things that Costa Rica did at one point was it shut down its borders so people couldn't leave.
Right.
So Nicaraguans working in Costa Rica who effectively were out of a job because of the Costa Rican measures against the COVID-19 virus, they decided to try and return to Nicaragua across the border at informal crossing points.
Right.
And then when they got back, this woman in her report explains how the local community asked MINSA, the health ministry here, to follow up these people and make sure that they were healthy, and that's what happened. But that's also an interesting point where it shows how imprudent it was of Nicaragua to keep its borders open so as to minimize that kind of traffic of people moving to and from Nicaragua without passing through formal frontier points.
Right.
So, and that's, I thought that was interesting. Another thing that was interesting this week is that a guy called James Phillips, who's I think he's a community, a U.S. community worker, and he's about my age, in his 60s, and he's been working a lot with his partner in Honduras, and he wrote an article in Counterpunch this week where he does a straight comparison between Nicaragua and Honduras. I thought the article was very interesting, although I don't agree politically with James Phillips about various things. He does seem to have written a very fair-minded piece in which he makes very clear that he thinks very highly of what Nicaragua has done in contrast to Honduras, because it focuses on the well-being of the most deprived people and the most vulnerable people in Nicaragua, whereas in Honduras, it's kind of straightforward militarization that negatively affects the most vulnerable impoverished sections of the Honduran economy. And so, you know, there are kind of very severe restrictions in Honduras that prevent people engaged in the informal economy in particular from earning a living.
Right.
Which is the exact opposite of what Nicaragua has done.
Right. Right. I mean, we have elements of that here in the U.S. too. The they issued a payment, a $1,200 payment to people who, I think to just about everyone, assuming that you filed a tax return last year or the year before. And if you didn't, then there's a whole lot of other stuff you have to go through that I don't know anyone that's had to go through. But some people that, you know, file regularly, you know, that are citizens of the United States and or legal residents, I assume, you know, I file a pro forma tax return. I'm retired. I don't make that much money. I had a deposit made into my bank account, you know, 2 weeks ago or something. There are people that I know that need the money really bad. They're not getting it because they haven't filed any papers because they live on the periphery. You know, they live at the edges. And there's a lot of people here like that. The most vulnerable people are the ones that are not going to benefit from this check from the government.
Yeah, and the result of that, those kinds of restrictive measures in the region generally have been both increasing repression and increasing hunger and unrest as a result, a direct result of hunger.
Right.
So in Panama at the moment, there are riots over food and people wanting to get back to work. And that's, you know, and that's, and Panama, in theory, is one of the more prosperous countries in the region. And in Honduras, there's been a corruption scandal as a result of people, of public officials making purchases from companies that overpriced the products that they were selling to the authorities.
Yeah.
And so, and the it's like everything changes, but everything stays the same. I mean, there's this terrible public health crisis, but the patterns of behavior hardly change at all. Right. And public corruption taking advantage of the crisis to make money out of overpricing, you know, and that's right. Just classic, isn't it?
Right. Right.
And so, and in El Salvador, Bukele, and it's very interesting the way the right wing here in the region have kind of tried to make Bukele some kind of idol, whereas in fact his policies are extremely aggressive against the most vulnerable parts of the population, and also incredibly brutal in terms of in human rights terms. For example, what he's done recently is he's tried to impose a policy in El Salvador's prisons. I don't know if you've seen any of the photos. If you can, you should anybody interested in this kind of stuff should try and look for photos of the Maras in prison. Sorry, the Maras are the organized crime gangs in Honduras and in El Salvador and Guatemala. But if you do a search for photos of the Maras in prison in El Salvador, you get these kind of almost apocalyptic-like photos of people crushed together under armed guard. You know, the very opposite of social distancing.
Wow!
It's like the government's crushing these people into small spaces.
Yeah,
and you have to see it to believe it. And unless you see the photos, you won't understand what I'm talking about.
I mean, even the BBC has photos like this. They got people. It looks like if you went to the SPCA and you saw cats in a cage, if you had a cage that would hold one cat, if you had like 30 cats piled into it, that's what the people looked like. They're pressed on top of each other, literally above and below, like in all directions, pressed against the bars. That's how crowded
Underarm guard. And if they try anything, they're shot dead. And what Bukele has done is he's promised legal immunity to all police and military if they shoot dead anybody that's breaching El Salvador's security restrictions as a result of the COVID-19 epidemic there.
Wow.
So this guy, he's an extremely close ally of the United States. The United States government loves Bukele.
Yeah.
And you can see why. So there, so when you look at that and contrast that with what's happening in Nicaragua, and in Nicaragua, what they've done recently is, and they do this regularly, they'll release hundreds of prisoners who are either close to the end of their term or are in jail for non-violent offences. They'll release them on kind of I don't know what the word is in I've forgotten my English, and they get conditional release,
right,
so they can live with families,
right,
but they still have to satisfy certain restrictions like reporting to the police regularly and so on.
It's like being on probation.
And Nicaragua did that recently. They did that about a month ago,
right,
in just as the COVID-19 epidemic was happening. And one of the reasons that they did that, of course, was to reduce the prison population so that it would be easier to avoid a mass outbreak of the virus among the prison population.
Right, of course.
So, but compare that with what Bukele has been doing in El Salvador or what's been happening in Honduras. And in Guatemala, they've been managing the crisis relatively well. Also in Costa Rica, they have a relatively high number of reported cases. But obviously, one of the things that I commented to you earlier before we came on to starting to record our conversation was that the actual number of confirmed cases is practically meaningless. Because it's obvious that if you have that number of confirmed cases, that's only people who've been tested and shown to
right,
or had symptoms and been tested. But there's a huge population that must have the virus,
right,
that simply they're just asymptomatic, and
right,
you know, and there's it's. Oh, now that's obvious. So in many ways, this numbers game is meaningless.
Well, part of it is when you're doing this kind of a study, time is one of the dimensions that you have to study. It's not just how many, you don't get a snapshot of 10 seconds. This thing, it passed from person to person. You as the population is infected, this is something that ripens with time. And so maybe only 1,000 people are symptomatic today, but it may be that 2 weeks from now, without any further exposure, 100,000 are going to be symptomatic, because you don't know who's got the virus, and you don't know what the incubation period is, and you don't know how individuals and groups of individuals are going to react in terms of displaying symptoms, because it's new.
Right. Well, it's not so new now, is it?
Right.
What is it now? When was the first case in Nicaragua was reported on March 18th?
Yeah.
But in other countries, there were reports of cases much earlier.
Right.
We're
only a couple months into it. We're out of time. I guess we're going to have to look at where things are at next week and see if there's any change that's evident in any of these places and some of the places we haven't covered yet. And appreciate you giving us your time, and we'll speak with you again then, Tony. Thanks.
Okay. You're very welcome, Don.
A reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting to us from Managua, Nicaragua.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.